Good morning. You're tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, we'll hear from Walter Echohawk, Native American speaker, attorney and author. And his latest book, A Sea of Grass, a family tale from the American heartland, tells the stories of 10 generations of the Echohawk family. He'll speak with us about the need to have Indigenous people tell their own stories. Then, the state of Colorado's forests. Last week, the Colorado State Forest Service presented legislators at the state capitol with the 2019 report on the health of Colorado's forests. We'll get a review. After that, Kathleen Tierney, Professor Emerita of Sociology and former Director of the Natural Hazards Research Center at the University of Colorado in Boulder, joins us to talk about why we need to be aware of xenophobic language that is being used by some officials in the light of the current coronavirus pandemic. After headlines from the BBC and a commentary from Jim Hightower, we'll be joined by a local virologist to talk about what's happening with the coronavirus and what we can do as individuals, but also as a community. At 9 o'clock, it is media analysis from Counterspin, rounding out this morning's news and public affairs. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Jamie Sudler.
The number of confirmed coronavirus cases in Colorado has risen to at least 135, with 34 people testing positive yesterday. So far, that is the largest single-day jump. COVID-19 is now confirmed in 17 Colorado counties. Denver County has the most cases with 25, followed by Eagle County with 24 and Arapahoe at 18. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment is recommending that people follow guidance from the National Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Among those recommendations, for the next 8 weeks, people should postpone in-person events that consist of 50 people or more. State officials said that they are not conducting drive-up testing today, but would begin tomorrow by appointment only, and that would be at a site yet to be determined. The first death from the virus in the state was confirmed on Friday in Colorado Springs. There are concerns that the victim, who was in her 80s, may have unknowingly exposed dozens of others at a bridge club. On Saturday night, Colorado Governor Jared Polis ordered all ski resorts to close for at least 1 week. However, his office said his order may be extended. The Colorado Sun reports that this order marks the most significant use of the governor's power since he declared a state of emergency last Tuesday. A spokesman for the governor said he was taking the step because some resorts would not close voluntarily. In Boulder County, officials announced 6 more residents had tested positive for COVID-19, which brings the total in the county to 7. One of those is a student at CU Boulder. Boulder County Public Health Director Jeff Zayek said in a release that as COVID-19 is now in the community, we are entering the most critical phase, and it is vital for everyone to be diligent about social distancing. People are advised to stay home if they are sick, and even if not sick, the county is recommending that people work from home if possible, if not to maintain at least 6 feet of distance from coworkers and customers. Healthy activities not involving groups like walking, hiking, and cycling are okay. And of course, washing hands often is still critical. Boulder County offices will remain open to provide necessary services, but many buildings will not be available to the public, and some services will be available only by phone or online. The Boulder City Council has announced it will hold an emergency meeting tonight at 5 p.m. to consider more efforts to slow the spread of the virus. Boulder Mayor Sam Weaver said that shutting down restaurants and bars is a possibility. All City of Boulder buildings will be closed. The Daily Camera reports that 3 other area municipalities have declared disaster emergencies. City buildings in Longmont are also closed. Tomorrow, the Longmont City Council will consider allowing its members to participate in future meetings from separate remote locations during the outbreak. The Colorado legislature will close its doors for at least the next 2 weeks as fears over the rapid spread of COVID-19 continue. Henry Schuyler has more.
Leaders from the House and Senate introduced the resolution on Friday to close the session temporarily. There are currently 350 bills still in progress in the House and Senate. Essential state personnel are still expected to show up for work even if those in the legislature will be staying home. This decision is consistent with the new recommendations from the Center for Disease Control to not have gatherings over 50 people over anywhere in the United States. House Speaker Casey Becker told the Denver Post that in a week or a single day, there can be thousands of people in the Capitol. And while lawmakers don't want to limit public access, continuing with the session could put a lot of people at risk because so many people gather here. A part of the Friday proposal was to ask the Colorado Supreme Court if the legislature's 120-day session had to be consecutive, or if they can take a period of time off before returning. On Saturday, lawmakers approved a measure to give the Democratic and Republican parties flexibility regarding the upcoming caucuses. The bill will allow the parties flexibility for remote participation and deadline extensions. As Governor Polis announced a state of emergency last Tuesday, schools, restaurants, and libraries have started to close statewide. Government-sanctioned programs such as SNAP will continue, as many will rely on these programs to feed their families, especially when working isn't an option. For KGNU, I'm Henry Schuyler.
In Denver, officials are taking steps to protect people experiencing homelessness from the coronavirus, including handing out supplies and communicating with shelters. The Denver Post reports that health experts and advocates for the homeless agree that the population is vulnerable, requiring special care. City crews began passing out wellness kits last week. As noted, all of the state's ski areas are closed. Colorado's mountain resort communities are facing an extensive spread of COVID-19. CDPHE epidemiologist Rachel Herlihy addressed conditions in Eagle, Gunnison, Pitkin, and Summit counties. Yesterday, local officials urged residents and visitors to minimize social contact and stay put. First steps to community quarantines are being taken, according to the Denver Post. Summit County officials asked residents not to leave the county unless absolutely necessary, and Governor Polis earlier advised people outside mountain resort communities counties to stay out if possible. In Telluride, a National Guard team arrived last night to conduct coronavirus testing and help San Miguel County health officials make decisions. All grocery store chains in Colorado are trying to stop shoppers from panic buying. Yesterday, a spokesperson for King Soopers told 9 News that there is no reason for people to be alarmed because they have an entire warehouse spanning nearly 20 acres filled with supplies to restock the chain's 153 stores. If customers aren't seeing some products on shelves, it's due to the amount of goods they can get to the store in a truckload and trying to get trucks to stores, not due to a shortage. Today's weather will be mostly sunny with a high near 57. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with the high near 53. Right now, it's about 34 along the Front Range. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
It is 11 minutes past 8 o'clock. Well, Walter Echo Hawke is a renowned Native American speaker, attorney, and author. And his latest book is Sea of Grass, a family tale from the American heartland. It tells the story of 10 generations of his family. And he said it is absolutely crucial that we allow space for Indigenous people and Native Americans to tell their own stories.
My book, The Sea of Grass, it recounts 10 generations of the Echo Hawke family in the Pawnee tribe here in the Central Plains, and kind of a Native American version of Roots, where I trace my family through our oral traditions as far back as I can go into the current day. And this is a story that the setting is in our Aboriginal homeland, which was from the Missouri River to the Rocky Mountain Front Range. You know, it was when the world was young, when the world was created, we were given stewardship over that region, about 500 miles by about 300 miles, you know, and made to live with Father Buffalo and grow our mother corn and living and roaming, you know, throughout this area here. And to us, it's a very marvelous homeland, and still here today, you know, our people are still here today. And so it's unfortunate that native history of Colorado and in general is a mystery to most Americans, you know, because it's not taught in the schools, and there is a big information gap out there about the Indigenous peoples in our nation. And so it's the time for Native people to find their own voice and tell our own stories, you know, and to reclaim our own histories, you know. And so that's my effort, you know, to do that with regard to my family and the Pawnee people, to provide a historical novel that gives voice to our history told through our perspective, and to try to present our Pawnee people in a more realistic fashion rather than a one-dimensional stereotype, you know, that comes to us in movies like Dances with Wolves and The Revenant, Little Big Man, and that sort of thing. And so that I think is the great failing in American history, is that it's usually told from the white perspective, which gives a very skewed history to this land.
And having those gaps in knowledge and having the erasure of Indigenous voices in the history that has been taught through mainstream education here, I mean, of course, then that trickles up into policy, into what happens right now in 2020 with the ongoing struggles of Indigenous people, would you say?
Yes, I fully agreed to with that, you know, as an Indigenous rights attorney since 1973, I feel like one of the greatest single problems that face Native America is this lack of reliable information about Native people. And, you know, what are our histories? What are our aspirations? What are our current issues and problems that we face, and when that lack of information or ignorance becomes enmeshed in the machinery of government, it can result in human rights violations, you know. So it's really important to address that information gap, you know.
Aside from reading your book, of course, how can we push these stories that feature Indigenous people telling their own stories and their own history into the mainstream, and particularly into education and into public schools?
That's the challenge. I think you've hit the nail right on the head. It has to. Our histories have to be taught to our young students. You know, the failing is in the at the doorstep of the public schools, and we just have to insist that the curriculum include Indigenous histories, and we also need to, I think, rename some of the sites, you know, to on the land, you know, to their Indigenous names would be helpful too, such as Pike's Peak is its true name is Duspe Mountain that touches the sky. It's a holy place, you know, to our people. And things of that nature, you know, to sort of indigenize our history, our public education, and even our landscape.
And decolonize all of that and acknowledge that we are on stolen land, I mean, right here in Boulder County.
Yes, for sure.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Walter Echo Hawk is a Native American speaker, attorney, and author. His latest book is Sea of Grass, a family tale from the American heartland. It is 8:17. You're listening to KGNU.
Support comes from Vivint Health, providing integrated medical, dental, and mental health clinics, pharmacy, and social services for all people affected by HIV. They strive to assure that everyone with HIV has the opportunity to thrive. More at vivanthealth.org.
Last week, the Colorado State Forest Service presented legislators at the state capitol with the 2019 report on the health of Colorado's forests. KGNU's Hannah Lee Myers spoke with Dr. Dan West, a forest entomologist with the State Forest Service, about the report.
So the Forest Health Report is a report that we produce annually. It's intended for state legislators and citizens of the state to get an idea as to the scope and scale of what's affecting our forests. And this particular year was an interesting one in 2019 because we kind of rebounded from the really drought warm season in the season of 2018. We then rebounded in 2019. Remember, we had this tremendous amount of snowpack. A fairly late spring season, And so it really affected a lot of our trees and a lot of our landscapes in kind of this pendulum swinging from it being so warm and dry in 2018 to it being fairly wet and cool in 2019. And so a couple of key things in that is that we saw some of our pests that affect our forest resources downtick a little bit or have the acreage that was actively affected were reduced that we recorded from aerial aircraft. So that's always kind of an interesting or a good thing, right, when we have more water than what we would on average. And so that affects tree defenses. And so that in turn affects the outbreak of some of these insects. Also of note, this year's report breaks out the highlights of each kind of quadrant of the state so that people can get a little bit zoned in or kind of a clearer picture of exactly where they're at or kind of places that they plan on going so that they can get a little bit closer local perspective rather than it just being the entire state.
So studying our Colorado forests so closely, what are some of the misconceptions or inaccuracies that you're encountering in your work and could clear up for us?
Well, sometimes the details matter. And unfortunately, through the late 1990s and early 2000s, we had what was called the mountain pine beetle outbreak in Colorado. And so that was a small bark beetle, so a little beetle that affected pine resources or pine trees. In particular, lodgepole pine and ponderosa pine in Colorado. If you combined both lodgepole and ponderosa pine resources in Colorado, it equates to about 4.1 million forested acres across all of the state. In those two decades, from the late 1990s through the early 2000s, we saw about 81% of our forest was affected by mountain pine beetle. On the flip side, since about 2000, we've really seen approximately 41% of all of our spruce fir forests affected by a small beetle that's the close relative to mountain pine beetle called the spruce beetle. This beetle, spruce beetle, affects high elevation Engelmann spruce trees. And so totally different from pine trees, right, that grow at lower elevations where a lot of us live, Engelmann spruce grow high in high elevations where a lot of our snowpack builds up and a lot of our kind of skiing and high elevation recreation occurs. And so it's really interesting to see that, you know, it's two different bugs affecting two different forest ecosystems, but the result is very similar. And, you know, when we really think about the impact of that, most of our water and our snowpack comes from those high elevations. And so what we see from some of these outbreaks is we see the solar radiation or the sun is able to penetrate down to the forest floor. It melts off our snowpack earlier, sometimes 2 to 3 weeks earlier than what we've seen historically. And that has impacts for storing our water for water retention as well as water quality. And so it really is kind of a misinformation when we really think about, you know, it's just a bug. It's several bugs that are native to our forest resources. The only problem is they typically serve as a sanitizer of the forest where they will come through and pick off the trees that have been lightning struck or might be damaged by some other agent, you know, might have root problems, whatever the issue might be. But when we get this envelope of environmental window that's just right for the tree defenses to be weakened, the bark beetles can then attack those trees and build up their populations to where it doesn't necessarily matter how much precipitation we get that these bark beetles will really continue to affect otherwise healthy trees. And so that also is part of it is that, you know, sometimes for some of these pests, they can just move tree to tree through a forest resource and kind of unabated by any of the precipitation or temperature regimes that we see. At that point, we really should have done the work ahead of the bark beetle and we're able to move through some of these forest resources and be able to, through forest management activities, make stands more resilient to some of these disturbances that we see, like, you know, mountain pine beetle and spruce beetle. That's one of the misnomers. And the other thing is that, you know, one of the kind of bits of misinformation is, you know, gosh, what are you guys doing? And we are doing a tremendous amount in identifying some of the priority areas where people live and we have wild and urban interface where, you know, folks are living and recreating and interacting with our forest resources. That's where we're trying to put the bulk of our energy so that we can affect the greater people of Colorado.
And where can people find out more and engage with this report?
As a bit of an accoutrement to the Forest Health Report, if you go onto the Colorado State Forest Service website, you'll be able to find county-by-county data that describes each forest pest and talks a little bit about the active acres in each county so that people can figure out exactly what is happening in their county. And then on that same website, if you go to the State Forest Service website and you search for Story Map, I've created an interactive tool where people can go on and plug in their address, or they can search around through the different pests and be able to interactively look and see what's active in their area. And so just as another education piece or tool, I'd encourage folks to go there and look at the story map. They'll be able to find a lot more information than I could ever give in a short period of time now.
Dr. Dan West is a forest entomologist with the State Forest Service, speaking there with KGNU's Hannah Lee Myers about the recent report on the health of Colorado's forests. It is 8:25. You're listening to KGNU. Well, the current outbreak of the coronavirus seems to be paired with another outbreak, and that's xenophobia. Kathleen Tierney, Professor Emerita of Sociology and former director of the Natural Hazards Research Center at the University of Colorado in Boulder, says we need to be aware of xenophobic language that's being used by some officials in the light of what's happening.
Yeah, let's talk about what's happening now with President Trump labeling coronavirus as a foreign virus. And there's a narrative that is being pushed by him and among his supporters that China did this to us. And we should blame China. We should blame the other. People are not shopping in Chinatowns in the United States. They're not going to Chinese restaurants. Come on. The Chinese-American couple that owns your neighborhood restaurant is not a threat to you. We have seen in the past in different epidemics and pandemics, different groups being scapegoated. Mostly immigrant groups and often lower class groups. And this is not what we want to see happen here. It shouldn't be happening here. But I'm afraid to say that what we're seeing is a continuation of the narrative strategy that's been undertaken by our national leadership in talking about immigrants infesting our country, in talking about people who are dirty, in talking about the danger that's presented by the other. And now we have a situation, a pandemic, where these attitudes and these kinds of behavior are being amplified. And the only thing that that is going to accomplish is to make us less safe.
Well, we reported last week on, I think, 170, 180 troops being sent to the US border in response to the coronavirus and this further amplification that people are a threat to us. People who are seeking refuge. And of course, there's a huge concern about people who are in prisons at the border, refugee asylum seekers in these massive camps, not just at the US-Mexico border, but really around the world and certainly in Europe and in Greece and Turkey. What could happen if they're exposed to the coronavirus as well? But this narrative that it's their fault, that they're the ones who are the threat, I mean, this is something that we've seen, you know, consistently, I think, through history, a scapegoating. How can people really be aware of those kind of narratives and the language that is often subtly, if not very overtly, inserted into coverage of what's happening right now?
Well, right now, it isn't subtle at all. And you can pick up those messages from governors, from members of Congress, from media personalities, and from the president himself. Again, this is being fed by a long-term narrative that started way before this pandemic about the danger that asylum seekers and immigrants present. These groups, such as the people who are imprisoned at the border or who are in camps in Mexico. These people should be viewed as people who are extremely vulnerable and in need of effective public health interventions to keep them safe, not as a threat to us.
Do we see this in other countries as well? Do we see this narrative emerge where there's a scapegoating, that it's a certain segment of society, certainly immigrants, that people, the blame is tried to be put, there's an attempt to put the blame on a certain group for natural disasters, for things that have absolutely nothing to do with them?
Well, I think that in many places in Europe, this is what we have been seeing with respect to refugees from the Middle East, where they're seen as the source of crime and disease and disruption. And this is fueling, of course, the rise of the radical right in Europe.
Beyond just being educated on that, is there a way to counteract that and to be aware that this is a very pervasive messaging we're seeing from the highest office in the land?
I think there's a need to call out those kinds of narratives when people hear them, and to just stop for a minute, and put yourself in the place of an asylum seeker. Put yourself in the place of a homeless person or a prisoner and think how you would feel if you were that person.
Professor Kathleen Tierney is the former director of the Natural Hazards and Research Center at the University of Colorado in Boulder.